You're tuned to Radio Prague Weekend Programming with me, Jan Wellinger, and a very warm welcome to you. In today's show, David Vaughan looks at the bohemian side of a classic American author. Wondering who? Well, you'll have to find out, or wait just a few moments, and that'll be in Czech books. We're going to continue with Czech science, which this week is a repeat, but is Mars-related. We thought it would be a good time to air that, given the recent landing, the recent Mars landing of Curiosity. And we'll round out the program with another edition of From the Archives. If you've ever wondered about how 19th century Czech settlers lived on the Great Plains of the American Midwest, there's no better way to find out than by reading the novels of Willa Cather. David Vaughan looks at the bohemian side of a classic American novelist who is surprisingly little known here in the Czech Republic.
When Willa Cather was growing up in small-town Nebraska in the 1880s, it was still frontier country. The broad prairies, for centuries home to Native American tribes, were being settled by a curious cross-section of European migrants and longer-established American settlers. Cather's life spanned 75 years, and she wrote novels on many aspects of American life and history, but she remains best loved for her trilogy of novels set in the rural Nebraska of her childhood. O Pioneers, written in 1913, The Song of the Lark of 1915, and most famously of all, My Antonia, which in 1918 firmly established Cather's reputation as a novelist. It is also the novel that focuses most strongly on the life of Czech immigrant families. Charles University student Misha Plitzkova has just completed a thesis on My Antonia, and we met to talk about some of these bohemian aspects of the novelist. She began by telling me more about Willa Cather's early life.
Her autobiography was quite an important issue in her books, since she drew on her knowledge of all those backgrounds, all those communities she had the opportunity to stay with. And she was born in Virginia, but she stayed there only like for 9 years, and then she moved to Nebraska.
And she was in fact born into a family that had been farming, and it's very well established for, I think, 6 generations. So they were real old American settlers, weren't they?
Yes, they were exactly this. So when they moved to Nebraska, they had those resources which other people who came there from Europe, those immigrants, lacked.
And Nebraska was very different, wasn't it?
Yes, it was like this tremendous new space opened to all new possibilities, but also there was no social order, no pre-established values or like community network. So it was all waiting to be filled with those new orders, imaginations of those newcomers.
And for Willa Cather, I mean, she was 9 years old at the time. It was the beginning of a real adventure, wasn't it?
Yes, she was open to all those new fascinating elements. And she was also quite an adventurous girl. So she got many friends from different communities, including the Czech community.
And this is, of course, where we get to the reason why we're talking about an American writer in Czech books, because a major part of her work draws from her childhood experiences and the experiences that she had as a young woman growing up in Nebraska, and so many of the families there were migrants from Bohemia, weren't they?
Yes, they were. So Cather, when she was a little girl, she got this friend. Her name was Annie Pavelka, so she was of Bohemian descent. And her life story was a substantial inspiration for her book, My Antonia, which is one of her most striking books.
And the novel gives us a lot of fascinating insights into the type of life that people were leading in these rural communities at the time, and also into the interaction between the old settlers and the new settlers. And it'd be nice to hear a little extract now. This is a passage from My Antonia, which describes the bohemian girls in this town, Black Hawk, which is in itself interesting, the names. It's an Indian name, isn't it? Which is another aspect in that book. And you really see how they were different from the old settlers.
The Bohemian and Scandinavian girls could not get positions as teachers because they had had no opportunity to learn the language. Determined to help in the struggle to clear the homestead from debt, they had no alternative but to go into service. Some of them, after they came to town, remained as serious and as discreet in behaviour as they had been when they ploughed and herded on their father's farm. Others, like the three Bohemian Marys, tried to make up for the years of youth they had lost. But every one of them did what she had set out to do and sent home those hard-earned dollars. The girls I knew were always helping to pay for ploughs and reapers, brood sows or steers to fatten. One result of this family solidarity was that the foreign farmers in our county were the first to become prosperous. After the fathers were out of debt, the daughters married the sons of neighbours, usually of like nationality, and the girls who once worked in Black Hawk kitchens are today managing big farms and fine families of their own. Their children are better off than the children of the town women they used to serve.
In this extract, we could see the division between the old settlers, those of probably mostly English descent, and those new coming settlers were confronted with so many difficulties, starting from the climatic challenges, to put it mildly, since, well...
Winters are very cold and summers are very hot in that part of the West, aren't they?
So it's difficult to adjust yourself to those two extremes. And they had like virtually no resources, no money. And America in general is based on the assumption that there are those groups which are regarded as the other of the nation. And the other in this context is applicable also to the immigrants, the newcomers, the European immigrants. And if we explore this concept, this is also applicable to African Americans, Native Americans, women in general, which is all present in the narrative. And all those characters, Native Americans, African Americans, they make a brief appearance in the book. And the heroine, Antonia, she's both a woman and an immigrant.
And even as we heard in that little extract, there's also clearly a sense that Willa Cather has that these immigrant groups were also very dynamic in a sense that they, because they were less governed by the established rules of the society as it already existed, the Bohemian farmers had a habit of becoming prosperous more quickly.
Yes, that's true. They were both more inventive, they were like willing to succeed because they had no other option than to work really hard and try to make their own way in this very competitive context. And also, they didn't have to so strictly obey those social rules which were necessary for the identity of those old settlers.
And I understand that the Czech immigrants, or the Bohemian immigrants, as they are always described in the book, were considered as particularly different in some way. Maybe was it because they were unlike the Swedes or the Norwegians, who were also in that part of America? Was it maybe because they were Catholic, or maybe because they were Slav, and therefore a little bit more distant from the Anglo-Saxon Protestant majority?
Yeah, we somehow get the sense, or at least in my Antonia, because this is the book where the Czech protagonists get the most of the space in the novel, that they're like this Bohemian influence in the broad sense of the word, since they embody those slightly disruptive elements in the community, while the Norwegians and other Scandinavian immigrants, they are more stable and they don't figure in the community as such an element.
There's been a lot of interest in recent years in Willa Cather's own biography, because she spent the last decades of her life living with another woman. She never overtly refers to her sexuality, but there has been a lot of interest, hasn't there, in whether or not she was lesbian. Then there have been questions about whether this is relevant, and it's quite a sensitive and quite a controversial aspect of her writing.
Yes, I think it's a very important element. When she was pursuing her studies in Nebraska University, she adopted a persona of will. And if you see her pictures, it's quite difficult to put a label on her appearance, since she used to wear male clothes and she fell in love with her friend. And then she moved back into the closet, or where, we don't know if it was true that she was closeted, but she decided to refashion herself according to those expectations, and she started to act as she was expected to act from the part of the society, and she came to terms with her role of a woman. But then she had those close relationships with a couple of women, either on the artistic level or on a more personal level, or it's difficult to extricate those two.
And in My Antonia, she chooses to write it from the perspective of a male narrator, Jim Burden, doesn't she?
Yes, but it is a very important fact. The first person narrator is Jim Burden, who is trying to somehow grasp his life narrative. And in the foreword, there is another voice, which is presumably the voice of Cather herself, and it is a female voice. So this interaction somehow destabilizes the gender question or gender issue in the book.
It would be nice to hear another little extract from the book. And again, given that this program is called Checkbooks, I think we have to come back again to the bohemian element in My Antonia. This is a little extract that's about that most classically Czech thing, mushrooms.
That night, while grandmother was getting supper, we opened the package Mrs. Shimada had given her. It was full of little brown chips that looked like the shavings of some root. They were as light as feathers, and the most noticeable thing about them was their penetrating, earthy odour. We could not determine whether they were animal or vegetable. They might be dried meat from some queer beast, Jim. They ain't dried fish, and they never grew on stalk or vine. I'm afraid of them. Anyhow, I shouldn't want to eat anything that had been shut up for months with old clothes and goose pillows. She threw the package into the stove, but I bit off a corner of one of the chips I held in my hand and chewed it tentatively. I never forgot the strange taste, though it was many years before I knew that those little brown shavings which the Shimadas had brought so far and treasured so jealously were dried mushrooms. They had been gathered, probably, in some deep bohemian forest.
So that's Americans confronted with the strange Czech tradition of cooking with mushrooms, which is clearly not something that was familiar to most Americans at the time when the novel is set in the second half of the 19th century. Finally, I'd like to ask you, given that Willa Cather writes about Czechs in My Antonia and in other novels, how much interest is there in this country in her writing, and have her novels all been translated into Czech?
Well, it's quite strange that most of her novels were not translated yet, or there are some translations which are quite old, so it's quite striking that she's not known at all.
And so you've just completed your fascinating thesis on Willa Cather. I have the impression you'd probably like at some stage to come back to her again. Am I right?
I would love to come back to her and somehow re-examine some of her later works and include other works and try to come up with a different angle to put this all together and somehow give more space to her concerns.
And let's hope that one result in the long run will also be that more of her work will appear in Czech translation.
It would be nice to see those translated or retranslated.
Well, Míša Plíšková, thank you very much indeed for talking to us at Radio Prague, and best of luck with your further studies. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you too.
That edition of Czech Books was written and presented by David Vaughan. If you'd like to comment, write to us here at the station. The address is english@radio.cz. As always, we very much welcome letters or emails from our listeners, and some of your comments may even make it onto the air in our mailbox program. Now, though, it's time for Czech Science, hosted by our very own Christian Falvey.
A year and a half ago on this program, we talked about the Mars 500, and the role that Czech psychologists are playing in that major endeavor. For a reminder, the aim of the project, among other things, is to test the steel of human nerves by locking six would-be astronauts in a mock spaceship, sending them to a mock Mars, and then bringing them back to the very real Moscow parking lot from whence they started their journey, a journey to nowhere but into the mind. The course of that journey was being monitored by the Czech company QED, which specializes in a psychoanalytical method called sociomapping, used to study and foster interpersonal relations on the so-called ship. The project is now over, at least for the astronauts, who were released on schedule this month. To find out how the project went from the Czech end, at least, I talked to Radvan Bachbok, the director of QED, who I asked how the method had proven itself.
I think we are at the very beginning of analysis of all things which are connected with communication within team. I think that you know main reason why we have sociomapping there. It is necessary to check if trend of communication is constant or if there are some risks, for example, from point of view of decrease of communication or some channels which are in stuck state. And if we find something problematic, we are able to give this information to control center and to ask them to debrief communication with members of team and to encourage them to find time for communication about communication.
Well, so they were there for a year and a half and you were monitoring them that whole time. So did they have any problems with communication? Did it come to any crisis points?
I think that in comparison with all experiments, this team was the best from point of ability to have good, not only quantity, but quality of communication. Of course, there are some problems. For example, if we have an international team, it is normal that there are some subgroups. National subgroup was subgroup of Russian astronauts, and it is visible in sociomaps that they were more closed to each other than to international members. But it's normal. In a team of six people, we haven't the same frequency of communication in all channels. Six people means 15 communication channels, and some of them are very good in terms of flexibility and exchange of information, and some of them aren't.
And are there any specific situations that you can tell us about? I assume much of it is still under lock and key, I guess not open to the public, but are there any situations that you can tell us about that occurred?
Yeah, it's too early because we don't want to open all information about this without going through this information with members of this team and control center. But I think that I can say that communication in this team was relatively stable. We supposed on previous research that at the end of isolation or at the end of this work is a big risk of decrease of communication. The critical point of all previous experiments was at the end before landing, and in this team it wasn't so critical. They were able to communicate in good quality till the end of this experiment.
So and there was nothing. So there was nothing that would have jeopardized the mission had it been a real mission to Mars and back.
I think that in this team, it wasn't big jeopardy. I think that partly it was caused by the fact that they have time for debrief communication and to think about this, because it improves our ability to be more mindful as for our communication and to be able to catch some long-term trends and to do something with this. So they had opportunity to think about communication with other members and to think about some misunderstandings and real state and ideal state. They had opportunity to think about next steps how they can improve communication.
Well, lastly, you use socio-mapping in others, many other situations, like in the workplace and elsewhere. What have you learned from this project, and how will it help your use of socio-mapping elsewhere?
Yes, we are able to have, for example, reliability of scales, how stable is communication during so long stay in isolation. We are able to differentiate some phases in team dynamics, because there are studies about team dynamics, and we can check them if we have the same scenarios visible in dynamics of our socio-map. For us, it is very, very important and very useful type of experiment. And we can correlate our data with some external data, for example, data biomedical or data about performance of this team. I think that it is good to find connections between communication and performance. And it is a very interesting question if there's a relation between these two things, team performance and team communication.
And that program was produced by Christian Falvey. I refer to it as Czech Science. My mistake, it is, of course, Science Journal. Now we turn to our final program for this day, which is another installment of our long-running history series, From the Archives, which is, of course, by David Vaughan.
In last week's From the Archives, we heard Jaroslav Hutka singing at the huge demonstration that took place in Prague's Letná Park on November the 25th, 1989. This was over a week after the Velvet Revolution had begun, but the hardliners in the Communist Party were still clinging on to power. The demonstration was a sign of the huge momentum for change that had built up in the previous days, and despite the cold weather with sleet and snow, it was attended by nearly a million people. A few hours earlier, the head of the Catholic Church in the Czech lands, Cardinal Tomášek, had led a mass at Prague's St. Vitus Cathedral. The mass was to celebrate the canonization of St. Agnes of Bohemia by Pope John Paul II just a few days before, and in her honour, the mighty Zygmunt bell rang out. This was one of the rare occasions in modern Czech history when the nation has united behind the Catholic Church, and many thousands gathered at the cathedral. The spiritual mood lingered into the afternoon, and the demonstration in Letná Park, just a few hundred metres to the east of the cathedral, was led by the dissident priest and former Charter 77 spokesman, Václav Mali. At the very end of the afternoon, Mali addressed the crowd.
Tak bych tuto chvíli zvláštní, neobvyklou.
I would like to round up this special and unusual occasion with a prayer. I'm a Catholic priest, and therefore I'd like to invite those who know how to pray to join me, and those who do not know the words to join me in spirit.
Kdo neznají slova, aby byli v duchu se mnou. Otče náš, jen jsi na nebesí.
At this point, Václav Mali recited the Lord's Prayer, and all who could joined in. At that moment, the Velvet Revolution was almost complete.
Amen. Děkuji.
A further demonstration took place in the same park the following day. On that occasion, the communist Prime Minister, Ladislav Adamec, also spoke, promising further reforms, but he failed to convince the crowds. 3 days later, the federal parliament succumbed to pressure and removed the article in the constitution guaranteeing the leading role of the Communist Party.
From the archives brings us to the end of today's program. We want to thank you so much for joining us. I'm Jan Wellinger for myself and all of us here at Radio Prague. Well, have a wonderful weekend and join us again soon.